thanks so much for having me. The people with the really expensive tickets didn't show tonight, so if anyone wants to move a little bit farther forward, you're more than welcome to. And I should say that I do have, I'm sorry that they're not here. Actually, I can't say that I'm not sorry that they're not here, but I do have a six-year-old and a three-year-old. And as I was leaving, the three-year-old said, "Daddy, don't forget this." And she handed me a large leaf from the magnolia leaf from the yard. And well, more about that later, but I'm not sure exactly what they think I'm doing. Although whenever they see that book in the bookstore, they always say, "Daddy, Daddy, look, your favorite book." And there was a reading that I did in Milwaukee at our local bookstore. We just very recently moved there, so they kind of did a welcome to Milwaukee type of thing. And they put a big poster of me up in the front and stacked all the books up, and it was very nice. And so, and there was it's a bookstore we go to all the time because it's around the block, and the girls would very admiring of it. And then we went into another bookstore, I guess a week later, and they'd taken everything down. And my little three-year-old went in and she goes, "Daddy, what's wrong with this store?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "They don't have your picture up." And I said, "I know, sweetie." She goes, "We're not coming here again for a very long time." So she plays for keeps, my children and PR agents. What I'm going to do tonight is a little bit of a different thing. I'm going to talk a little bit about fiction and a little bit about nonfiction. And so it's not going to be just a pure reading. It's actually going to be a little bit of a reading embedded inside a larger talk. It'll be the quickest 3 hours that you ever spend at this. No, it's not going to be nearly that long. But I did want to say that it's embedded in all this, and it talks about some things that I think have been very much kind of on writers' minds this recent spring, and at least I know they've been on my mind. And it's also a different way for me to talk about some of the things that interest me. And then frankly, because Mary said, I knew that this was kind of a different sort of reading for me, and it was a warmer, more intimate setting. I decided that I would go in a little bit different direction, and so I'm going to be kind of candid and tell people the story behind the story of the Cloud Atlas, since that interests a lot of people, as well as tell you the foreground story. So, fair warning, it's a little bit candid. It's all G-rated for the most part, but if you're the type who's easily overwhelmed, you may want to come up and borrow my water at some point, okay? But we're going to secure the doors now so no one can leave. All right. I'm going to start with the secret. And it was something another writer told me, an older, wiser writer, who had read an early draft of my first novel, The Cloud Atlas. "I think she has a secret," was what this writer said. And it was a simple sentence, six words, but it was probably the most provocative any reader of mine has ever given me. It was June, and I had received my MFA degree the month before, and now I was sitting down with my thesis director, the novelist Susan Richard Shreve, to talk about my book. My book. I was still startled that she was calling it that, but even more unsettling was the fact that she was calling it something else. She was calling it unfinished. And here, I thought I had finished it. It was 300 pages. It had a beginning. It had a middle and an end. But it wasn't done. Susan thought that the main female character, Lily, had a secret. I nodded. I thought so too. But Lily was as much a mystery to me as she was to the book's narrator. If she had a secret, she wasn't telling, not me. "I think you need to find that secret out," Susan said. Fiction writing occupies a strange place in colleges. I teach in a college, and everywhere else in the university, every other classroom, every other desk, we demand one thing of students: the truth. We establish and we observe honor codes, we fight plagiarism, we police sources, we tell students we want them to use their minds creatively, but the one thing we don't want them to be creative with is the truth. What's the closest planet to the sun? If 2x equals 4, what's x? What date did World War II end? Quand l'opera with Ischuri Sutte opens? What famous poetic work? In short, we ask them for the truth, and then they come into their fiction workshop and we ask them to lie. In a creative nonfiction class, it's not quite as confusing, or it is. If nonfiction is about telling the truth, why do we favor a word that permanently marries a genre to its opposite, nonfiction? And if that weren't unsettling enough for our students, we sometimes tack on that adjective creative. Now, creative license means to take liberties. Creative expression means to roam free of the narrow path. Creative nonfiction means what? Turns out, shockingly, that creative nonfiction means the same thing as fiction, at least in the classes that I teach. It means, at heart, telling the truth. It means, at length, writing what you don't know. It means, at the end, sharing a secret. And that's what I'd like to do today. I'd like to tell you about my teaching, my writing, myself. And before I leave, a secret. Over the course of the evening, I'm going to read for two of my works, one nonfiction and one fiction. The nonfiction comes from a personal essay that was published in a magazine not too long ago, and the fiction is from my first novel, The Cloud Atlas. The secret lies, and the word is carefully chosen there, somewhere in between. First, I'd like to introduce you to another important character in my story, Chief Warrant Officer Bartleson, another man with a secret. I should clarify, Chief Bartleson, who lives, by the way, just down the road in Hampton Roads, is a real person, a World War II veteran, a former Navy bomb disposal man. Or maybe I shouldn't clarify who's real and who's not. The narrator of my novel, for example, is an Army Air Corps veteran named Louis Belk. So you can imagine my surprise isn't quite enough of a word when shortly after publication, an email popped up in my inbox from Louis Belk, now an elderly World War II Army Air Corps veteran who at the age of 80 had gone onto the internet for the first time, Googled his name, and now wanted to know why I had written a book about him. But let's go back to Chief Bartleson. I found him after completing a first draft of the novel. Another early reader of my draft observed that one odd aspect of my book was that despite the narrator's professing to have spent his service years as a bomb disposal expert, not a single page of my book had him defusing a bomb. Well, of course not, I told my reader. I have no idea how to defuse a bomb. This reader told me that I might want to learn. So here's what I found out, and I'm going to read a part of the book now. I had earned my way into explosives training, in part because I was book smart and good with diagrams, but more because I scored the absolute lowest of any recruit ever in marksmanship. As one sergeant put it, me with a gun in my hand was a bomb waiting to go off, so why not volunteer to go to school where I could learn to prevent similar explosions? I did learn, quickly, and I became consumed with strange twin desires, one to prove myself so expert that those who once laughed at me would feel ashamed that they ever had, and two, to edge as close to death as I could, as often as I could, with the faint, teenaged hope that I might just die, and those who once laughed at me would feel even worse. I got a laugh line when I read this at a boys' school, too, and I thought that rather chilling. My drive was mistaken for talent, my recklessness for courage, and the result was I was promoted so rapidly that I made sergeant in a matter of months. I trained in Maryland, but it turned out I would finish my training in California at Fort Cronkite. Viewed from the ridgetop gun emplacements, the coastal Fort Cronkite in the Marin Headlands just across the Golden Gate from San Francisco resembled a California-style summer camp, broad, meadowed hillsides gone gold for lack of rain, the ocean beyond making a slow, vain, glittering entrance late each morning as the fog burned off. I had been shadowing a colonel as he inspected the concrete bunkers when we suddenly heard shouting from outside. I followed him out and, blinking rapidly, tried to figure out why a piece of the summer sky had torn loose and was floating toward us. "Stand by to fire!" screamed the colonel, but it was a moment before anyone moved. It looked like a balloon, and it swung toward us like a hypnotist's watch, an ordinary thing working some extraordinary magic. Once I separated it from the sun, I realized that it was a balloon, and an unusual one, 30 or so feet in diameter and slender. It was more than slender, actually. It looked starved and weak, a dirty gray. The bottom half of the balloon was partially deflated. A quick glance would mistake it for a parachute, but down beneath, we'd expect some person to dangle, hung instead a kind of crate that hardly seemed worth the balloon's trouble. "Weather balloon, sir?" asked another sergeant, squinting. "I don't know. I heard some guys down in Monterey get an awful kind of trouble for shooting down a..." "Stand by to fire!" the colonel shrieked, his voice getting higher instead of louder. The sergeant backed up a step and then skipped into a slow trot toward his bunker. But the colonel wouldn't issue the order to fire. He just stood there, same as me, and stared the balloon all the way down to the ground. I think we didn't move because it was so quiet. Except for the moon, there's nothing in life that big that ever moves so silently. Even a sailboat makes a sound, the sailing, the rigging, the water boiling past. But these balloons, 6 or 7 stories tall, they move silently. The only sound they made was when they landed, as this one soon did. Its payload scraped into a fold in the hill a few hundred yards off, and for a moment the balloon floated there, stuck. "Stand down," said the colonel. I looked down the hill and saw that some curious soldiers were already climbing toward it. The colonel summoned a pair of binoculars and studied the balloon for a while until a gust of wind came. The balloon popped free, dragged itself and its cargo a few yards up the hill, and then gave up once more. The colonel handed me the glasses, which I thought generous, until I realized he didn't want to hold on to them anymore. What the hell can a balloon tell you about the weather, sir? Sergeant, he said, staring after it. I don't know, sir, I mumbled, adjusting the focus. Finally, I found the curious soldiers. I scanned the hill ahead of them along the path that the balloon had torn through the grass and brush until I reached the balloon itself. Something had pierced the envelope. It lay on its side as though gasping like a beached whale. I held my breath as I followed the balloon shroud down to its payload. I'd never seen a hot air balloon other than in photographs, and if anything, this balloon looked more incredible on the ground than it had in the air. The soldiers were almost upon it now, and I frowned, realizing that they would soon obstruct my view. That's when I saw the fuse. And then another, and another, and then a whole tangle of them came into view as I studied the payload more closely and realized that each was a carefully wired charge. It's a bomb, sir, I said. But I couldn't be sure. The soldiers were in the way now, milling about, but it had to be. I'd never seen a weather balloon, but I'd seen plenty of bombs in the classroom, and they... Sergeant, the colonel asked, as if I'd reported sighting a seagull. A bomb, a bomb, a bomb, I said, the words tumbling out so rapidly it felt as though they were causing me to fall forward, and then I was falling, running down the hillside toward the balloon. As I ran, I stumbled. The binoculars caught me in the jaw. I tore them off and threw them away, yelling all the while. Behind me, the colonel must have been yelling too, but I don't remember that. I only remember thinking for a split second that I had indeed full time, that I was the only one moving. The soldiers, the bomb-laden balloon, the colonel, everyone was still, awaiting my intercession. The first blast, just the noise, not the force, sent me to the ground. When I got up, I saw flames and heard screams so fierce it was like I could see the sound. I began running even faster until I heard the second blast, tripped again, and lying there, finally realized I was too late. One of the balloon's incendiaries must have detonated. It was later determined that the first blast had only wounded one or two of the soldiers, but the fire ended up claiming them all. The fire would have caught up with me as well, except that within a minute or so more of scrambling, I was stopped by a steep, sharp ravine. I picked my way down into it, but then discovered I couldn't climb to the other side. Eventually, I had to follow the ravine all the way down to the beachhead, watching the smoke billow above me, just out of reach. I had developed an email friendship with Chief Warrant Officer Bartleson, and I asked him if he would read my text over for accuracy, things like I just wrote, to see if, in writing fiction, I was actually telling the truth, and he kindly agreed. He had no trouble whatsoever with the strange device at the heart of the book, which is a balloon that the narrator here has just described. It's a gigantic, gas-filled, bomb-laden paper balloon, quite accurately depicted here on the cover, that Japan sent over at the end of the war. They made about 10,000 of them, and they think about only 1,000 of them actually made it to these shores. To this day, only 300 have been found. This is all true, but I needed Chief Bartleson to help me with my fiction. My young bomb disposal sergeant in the passage I had just read failed in his attempt to save these soldiers' lives. Could the chief help? I wrote another scene. This one took place in a Japanese internment camp in California. An American bomber on a training mission accidentally drops a bomb on the camp, and it fails to go off. Lewis, who is the narrator, and his team are called in. I couldn't duck the subject of bomb disposal this time. I actually had to have Lewis defuse a bomb, and so I needed Chief Bartleson to help. The chief told me this might be difficult. He was enlisted. Only officers defused bombs. Clink. I knew infantry guys who would always claim that the bullet or shell or bomb that was actually going to hit you had a different sound, different from the bullets that whizzed by safely, I suppose. I'm reading from the book now. But in bomb disposal, there was only that one sound, clink, the sound of a shovel or pick gone too far. And if you heard it, you usually weren't around afterward to describe the experience in detail. Of course, the other reason you almost never heard it was because experienced bomb disposal men were more careful than I was, probing first, then probing, digging, never just diving in. I've been probing, I promise. I've been careful. It wasn't that loud a clink. But this was a bomb that wouldn't go off. It had fallen thousands of feet from an airplane. It had broken through a roof and a floor and a mess of equipment for making pots, and it wasn't going to explode just because some trainee had nicked it with a shovel. It was designed for rough handling, after all. It had to survive transport from the factory, then loading onto the airplane, rough weather in the sky, before being dropped. Still, a bomb's patience was usually about spent by the time guys like us found it. So after my clink, no, none of us breathed, none of us moved, and none of us said anything until someone weakly said, "Sarge." Sergeant Redis, our boss, was in the doorway above us before the sound had left the air. "Who's the dipshit trying to get us killed?" I suppose I should have put down the shovel and pretended it was someone else, but I was still motionless, scared. "Belk," Redis said. That's the narrator's name. "I was being careful, sir," I said, though I wasn't sure I had been. "Careful?" To our great relief, he started climbing down into the hole. He wasn't scared. "Jesus, Belk," he said at the bottom. "Careful. What do we say?" I wasn't smiling then, but I'm smiling now because I know we said what Lily, my friend, the local palm reader, said. We said, "Careful and correct." Though Redis hadn't said much since joining our unit, he'd said enough we knew this was a favorite phrase. I'd heard a half dozen instructors say it, but Redis made it his own through repetition and embellishment. "You could be as careful as you wanted," he'd always say, "but if you didn't follow procedures correctly, you could still blow yourself up with great care." I should have been paying more attention, watching the soil, stopping to test with the probe. "Careful and correct," I said. "Correct," Redis said. "And since you're the whiz kid, you've earned the prize of finishing this job off. The rest of you out. Belk, finish exposing the bomb." The rest of the gang climbed out, delighted to get away from the bomb and the sergeant's wrath. Sergeant Redis descended and watched me dig for a minute or two before he spoke. "I did the same thing, you know. Clink." He looked out of the hole, shook his head. I thought he would get mad if I stopped digging, but I did anyway. "Did your sergeant get mad?" I asked. "I was the sergeant," he said. "Last day before I left France, right in the middle of the town square, 10 yards maybe from the front door of this church. It was like 1,000 years old or something. Everybody from my lieutenant to the Monsignor, some passing colonel, looking on, watching the experienced sergeant do his work." Clink. "What happened?" "Nothing, same as here." He bent down, ran his hands lightly over the bomb, and let out a long breath before muttering, "This is odd." He studied it for a minute more, agreed with himself about something, and then he said, "You know the lieutenant? He's got a sister." I didn't, but I knew enough about army life to brace myself for something coarse. "Redhead," he said. "So I hear." He showed me her picture, black and white, pretty. "I suppose the lieutenant's a little red up top too," Rita said. He turned to look at me. "That's the thing of it. They were twins," he tells me. "Boy-girl twins. What do you call that?" I shook my head, and he turned back to the bomb. "So she's a whack nurse," he said. "Was. Died. Monday. Italy. Jeep. Landmine." "That's hard," I said. And Redis waited for me to say something more, something adequate. When I didn't, he turned back to the bomb. "They're not giving him leave till the end of the month. That's hard. Now you give me a hand here." Redis had both hands on the bomb and was trying to roll it back toward him. We studied it, and then he paused and looked out of the hole. "You're my best student, you know. Or were." He smiled. Then the lieutenant called his name from up above, and Redis told me to wait. He climbed up to the lip of the hole and told the lieutenant that he needed just a few more minutes to finish clearing the site. Then he came back down to the bottom of the pit, excited. "So let's finish your training, huh? What do you think? What do we do next?" Well, let's see. I go and get a couple of sticks of C2 or C3, and I run some blasting wire back, clear the fragmentation zone, and I hook it up to the blasting machine. I could see the little pages of my training manual flutter past in my head. "What the hell are you talking about?" Rita said. "I'm sorry, the 50 cap blasting machine," I said, I think. "The what?" "Let's call it what it is, soldier. You're talking about that little box with the plunger you push down, make everything go boom?" I nodded my head. He said, "That's called the hell box, right? Don't bother calling me anything else they told you in your fancy little school." I nodded again. "Okay," he said. "That's a lovely plan. But what's the problem with that plan?" I was still stuck on the word hell box, so his question caught me off guard. Not enough wire?" Redis looked at me and then rubbed his hands together slowly. "Right, not enough wire. Belk, there's not enough wire in the world for this job. The problem with that plan, we blow this bomb where it is, we flatten the camp, which, since it looks like it's made out of balsa wood, we could probably level with a couple of lit farts. In any case, all that means we take care of the problem here." He pointed to the bomb. "So let's get started. There's something extremely strange about this bomb." "What is it?" I looked at it for a long time. It didn't look strange. It looked like all the bombs in the manual, markings and all. I shrugged. "Where's the fuse pocket?" he said. I relaxed, glad to be back on familiar ground. This question was easy. Like most guys, I come into bomb disposal thinking that the business end of the bomb was always the nose, but that wasn't the case. Sometimes the fuse was in a cylinder or pocket embedded in the middle, as it was here. "Right there," I said, pointing to the middle of the bomb. "Transverse fusing, German specialty." Sergeant Belt looked at me and waited. I waited too, pleased with my vocabulary, and then I gasped. "This is a German bomb. the Nazis, oh my God, oh my God, a German air raid over California. Only now did Rita look concerned. Not so loud, Belk. You already tried to set the bomb off. Let's not try to set the camp gossips off, too. He squatted. The truth, according to the lieutenant who radioed the airfield, is that they've been using some captured Nazi ordnance out in the test range. Why waste good American ammo and all that? Though the lieutenant doesn't quite buy that, and neither do I. For starters, they'd have the wrong damn charging shackles, and there's probably a good thing because the condensers wouldn't... Well, I'm guessing there's a pilot and crew who are going to have a hell of an interesting debriefing. A German bomb. I stared at it. I read the papers. We had the Germans on the run. We landed in Normandy that June. We were going to win in Europe. I knew it. I thought everyone did. And yet here I was in the middle of California staring at a German bomb. But this is good news, said Rita's, right? Because this is all I've seen for the past year or so, and it's probably all you saw in your classroom. It was. I could see the training films in my head. If you had the right tool, and Rita's did, I was surprised to see, a funny kind of two-pin wrench, you could unscrew the keep ring and access the fuse pocket. Then you could remove the fuse. You weren't quite done. The fuse was its own kind of mini-bomb, and screwed onto one end of it was a donut-shaped gain, which was what provided the initial charge. And once you'd unscrewed the gain, you could breathe a little easier, because the fuse without the gain was like a gun without a trigger, and a bomb without a fuse was basically a mess of explosives in a handy carrying case. Dangerous, sure, but disassembled, you could toss the parts, or maybe toss isn't the right word, into the back of a truck and cart it all off to some lonely pit and blow it up. But you couldn't do any of that unless you removed or disabled the fuse, and only an officer could do that. Which is why I was surprised to see Sergeant Rita start in on the job, narrating what he was doing the whole time. Say what you will about your Nazis, he said, they build a good bomb. Don't repeat that, there's no such thing as a good bomb, and every now and then they get sneaky, that's not so good. But the thing is, they're well made. Here he strained with a little effort as he got into a better position. For the most part, built tough. He fit his spanner wrench to the keep ring. I swear I could see him tense and hold his breath. I was already holding mine. Then he did something incredible. He turned the wrench. The ring resisted. He put a second hand to it, grunted, held his breath again and tried again. This time the ring scraped open an eighth of a turn. He exhaled and smiled. No, she's not going to give us any trouble. Normally you give a little listen, but we know this animal, right? Hell, I've worked on lots more German bombs than American ones. That's good, I whispered, because that was all the voice I could muster. Well, we'll see. He turned the tool again and the ring scraped around a bit more. Finally began to move more freely. He turned it around and around till it was completely loose. Now I was really scared. Not just because we had the most dangerous part of the bomb in our hands, but because what we were doing was clearly against the rules as I knew them. One, the officer defuses the bomb. Two, only one man does the job to minimize the potential loss of life. I looked up. What if the lieutenant decided to peer over the side now? I felt around for my shovel. I was just digging. Rita's rocked back on his haunches for a second, surveyed his progress. Now, American bombs, fuse in the nose or the tail, honest piece of business for the most part, but you know what? I'm glad it's the enemy that's got to defuse them, most of them anyway. He looked at me. Belk, what's next? British bombs? My whiz, kid, he said. No, what's next to do here? Call for the lieutenant? Rita's looked at me. I thought I explained, he said. I thought about the lieutenant's red-haired sister and tried to imagine what she looked like, his twin. I looked back up to the top of the hole and then to Rita's. Pull out the fuse, and then call lieutenant. Rita shook his head. And then remove the gain, I said. Good boy, he said. He leaned forward to look at it more closely. He shifted the side a bit, motioned me over. Let's hope it's not damaged. So what you're gonna do now, the sound of lieutenant's angry cut him off. Rita's yelled up a quick apology, changed his mind about something, and turned back to me, is watch me work very quickly. He slowly drew the fuse out of the bomb, found the gain, unscrewed it, and delicately set it all beside the case. You see all that, he said. You get a good look? Because you're not likely to see that again, something that wrong, that rare. A bomb with a fuse that just falls out and arranges itself alongside. In fact, now I'm back into my description, you would have never seen this, because you can ask me or you can ask Chief Bartleson. I had asked him straight out how to defuse an American bomb. I had found a book in the library, an Englishman's memoir about defusing German bombs, but the Englishman had nothing to say about American bombs. So, Chief Bartleson, how do you defuse World War II American bombs, 500 pounds or more? I'm not at liberty to say. said the chief. I said, what? I mean, because if you don't tell me, I'm going to have to write this scene as though a German bomb dropped into the California desert. Honestly now, how do you defuse an American bomb? It's a secret. So write what you don't know is what I've always told my students. At first, I did it out of defensiveness. When I first started teaching, I felt like I didn't know anything, not about writing, not about life. But we grew into this rule, my students and I, with great success. We write to learn about worlds unknown to us, or for like me, World War II Alaska, to learn about the fragments of histories too impossible to be true, that paper balloons cross the ocean. And then finally, we learn what we are really writing about, balloons, bombs, or believing in something that can't possibly be real. One of my students later told me that this was the best thing I could have ever told her. Don't write what you know, I had said at the outset of that particular class at Georgetown, and she went home relieved. She knew what it was like to be a caterer, a mom, a woman who had gone to the funeral of a friend who had died too young, and had since committed herself to making sure that she lived out her dreams before she too died. This woman wanted to write. She wrote a novel about a sushi chef and the affair he had with an alcoholic waitress in Manhattan. And despite the fact that this woman was not herself an alcoholic waitress, but the mother of two boys in horse country just outside Leesburg, but she sold the novel and a second novel, and last year published her third. Her name is Nanny Power. That first book is called Crawling at Night. It's wonderful. What do you know is what I ask students. I think what limits many students' creative writing is their lack of creativity. They look no farther than their fingertips for the story. They just start typing. That's fine if the story is there, but what if it's not? I encourage them to tackle subjects that may challenge them more, subjects that they may need to research. I ask them to write about what they don't know, what they don't understand. And I would ask the same of nonfiction students. What do you want to know? What stories do you want to tell? And I push their fingertips past the keyboard, to the phone, to the newspaper, to the offices, doors of offices and homes of people they don't know. Make them venture out and report, in other words. Venture out physically and metaphysically. Write what you don't know is what I tell them. Does it work every time? Yes. No. Yes, it works in pushing them, in exercising their abilities and developing skills they'll be able to use again and again. But in and of itself, it doesn't always work. But that's what we write to find out. Can I make this completely foreign world real, first to me and then to the reader? Sometimes we can. Sometimes we can't. But we have to try. So Susan Treve told me that my female lead, Lily, had a secret. I knew Lily did, of course. I assumed this is why that Lily had come into the book. Lily was part Yupik Eskimo, and I knew that the most important balloon in my novel was going to land in Yupik Eskimo country, deep in southwestern Alaska. My sergeant would need her help to find his way around. But as I started writing the characters farther and farther out into the tundra, I realized that Lily was leading them towards something else, a different secret, a secret that, in fact, she and I shared. She knew something that, still today, almost all the readers of my book do not know. Lily knew who Lucy was. Lucy, and here I'm reading from that magazine essay, is not the name of my first girlfriend. But I knew I would get questions like this when I published my first novel. I didn't expect this one, nor did my wife, so she's been startled whenever someone asks, giggling but insistent, was Lucy your husband's first girlfriend? They ask because my wife's name is also not Lucy, yet the book's dedication is to Lucy. Would that I had had such a map. Maybe it's the word map, which plays off the book's title, The Cloud Atlas, that makes people think girlfriend. Men are renowned for always wanting to track down old flames. But for the record, my first girlfriend's, or first date, her name was Tina. We had spent a whole year sitting next to each other in eighth grade. When I finally asked her out, it was to The Right Stuff, a long movie about tough men who must have made an eighth grader like me seem like far, far less of a catch. I remember it still. Tina tried to leave the movie at intermission. She said she thought that it was over. Later that night, on the side stoop of her parents' house, she waited a minute or an hour for me to kiss her. I never did. Perhaps if I had, I would have dedicated the book to her because we would have fallen in love, gotten married, and lived happily ever after. But instead, the door closed. I went home. And today, if I was to go in search of Tina to apologize for losing my nerve on the stoop or taking her to a 3-hour and 13-minute movie on our first date, I would need a map because I have no idea where she is. But then again, I have no idea of Lucy's precise whereabouts either. Mount Olivet is one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest Catholic cemeteries, and is where generations of prominent Washington Catholics were buried before they started moving to and dying in the suburbs. Some French and German names appear on the oldest stones, otherwise they're all Irish. The newest stones are largely given over to Latino names. My daughter's stone, hard by the cemetery's rear fence, bears the first Irish surname in several decades. Lucy Callanan, the stone reads, our beloved daughter. The neighboring stones all speak of similar losses. Some are toddlers, some grade schoolers, but for the most part, those buried here are babies. And it is why, as is often the case, the part of the ground set aside for the youngest dead is called Babyland. I cannot explain why this does not make me wince, but it never has. Perhaps it is the steadfast, high seriousness with which cemetery officials always employed the term with me. Perhaps it is because Babyland seems so unserious, thick as it is with toys and flowers and pinwheels and limp balloons. Enough children have been buried at Mount Olivet that they already have run out of room once before. Lucy Stone sits near the back of New Babyland, Old Babyland several hundred yards away, tucked along another fence near the groundskeeper's mulch mountain, reached capacity some time ago. New Babyland is filling now, too. If the city's children keep dying at the rate evidenced at Mount Olivet, the cemetery will soon be out of room. I'm not sure what grieving parents will do then. Perhaps they'll follow everyone else out to the suburbs. Perhaps the children already interred will be asked if they want to double up bunk bed style beneath the ground. I suppose we could spare the room for them in the plot we purchased for Lucy in the unlikely event we were ever asked. For underneath my daughter's name, underneath the single date, February 19th, 1998, underneath the 600-pound granite marker impediment that the stonemason, in a halting voice, attempted to give us for free, there is no casket. There are no ashes. There's absolutely nothing at all. I had imagined the drive to the hospital quite often, but quite differently. Careening through rain-slicked streets well past midnight, no one else about. Expect for a policeman, a cop car, he'd see us launch out of his hiding spot to give chase. Lights only, no siren, because they always try and run quiet at night. But I don't stop, and Susan, my wife, sits in the passenger seat, breathing, gasping, hand on her stomach, another on the dash, mouth open, unable to speak. This is an emergency, and the policeman will know that when we arrive at the hospital's emergency entrance, where I burst out of the car, and he out of his. He stops short when he sees me, gently extracts Susan from the passenger side, pregnant, stricken, and now the only light in the world is pouring from the emergency room entrance, and we disappear into it in pursuit of our child. In truth, there was no policeman. No rain-slicked streets, no midnight. We drove to the hospital downtown with the rest of the morning rush hour. I offered to drop Susan off while I looked for parking, but she didn't want to go in alone, so we nosed about, looking for a garage. I found a cheap one a few blocks away, and parking at the top, locked the doors, and then walked down to the street. We held hands while we waited for the light to change, crossed, and slowly worked our way around three sides of the hospital before we found the right entrance. The receptionist in labor and delivery gave us one of those little smiles medical people give you when they know what's coming will be painful, except that they know better. Susan undressed and got in her gown and sat on the edge of the bed, her bare feet dangling just above the floor. Her doctor had yet to show. I was sent downstairs to do paperwork. When I returned, the doctor arrived. Susan's mother and stepfather arrived. While Susan talked with them, the doctor took me into the hallway and explained quietly that because of the circumstances, this could take a while, 30 hours or more. It did not, because then I was holding her, my daughter. It didn't happen that quickly, but almost. One minute we were parking in the garage, crossing the street with the light. The next we were alone in the room, just Susan and I and our first child, holding her, afraid to touch her. She was beautiful, Lucy. She had fair hair, these rosebud lips that people tell me every baby has, but those are people who know nothing about roses or daughters. Her legs, they went on and on. Babies are always discussed in terms of weight and length, but my daughter, fresh out, was not long. She was tall. I thought I would recognize her face from the sonogram, but I did not. It was not black and white, for one. It was beautiful, full color, cheeks, nose, chin, those lips and eyes. This is why they had initially deliberated, the doctor and nurse, before the nurse took Lucy away briefly to clean her up. This is why the doctor explained delicately that we needed to understand that our baby, our daughter, was a wounded little girl. This must be why she cried, the doctor did, the only time I've seen a real live doctor cry. Your daughter, she said. Of course, she died some time ago. My daughter died in Atlanta. That is, we have no idea the exact moment when or where she died, but I always think of Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport, where I just landed on what had already been determined would be my last business trip. The baby was due in just a few weeks. I was in a limousine along with several other executives from the company where I worked. Alphanumeric pagers were fairly new then, but our employer made a point of sending us into battle with the latest technology. As we began to drive away from the curb, my pager buzzed, and I thumbed through the message. Call doctor's office. Cannot detect baby's heartbeat. I didn't understand. I truly didn't. A setback, certainly. A serious one. But my wife was in the doctor's office. If something needed taken care of, they would do it. But on the seat next to me was a woman, the only woman in our group, a mother. Oh, Liam, she said, and hugged me tight. The limo stopped. I got out and ran back through the airport. I boarded the exact same plane I'd arrived on and flew back to Washington. After Lucy was born, a social worker visited us in the hospital room. What would we like to do with the body? Would we like the hospital to take care of things? Susan was asleep. I desperately wanted someone to take care of things. Yes, I said. 3 days later, of Susan's breasts weeping milk when a baby anywhere down the hospital hall on the television or sidewalk cried. 3 days of sympathy flowers perfuming our house to suffocation. 3 nights without sleep, I found the social worker's card and called her. It was 3:30 in the morning. We've changed our mind, I told her voicemail. We want the body. We want her, Lucy, to bury her. Why? Because when I called the church to ask about a memorial service and the priest had asked where Lucy now was, I had to say, I don't know. Because the anguished hour that we had spent with Lucy in the hospital, not knowing what to do with her, turned out to be not nearly long enough. Because I now understood myself to be a father, albeit one without a daughter, and I understood that I had somehow failed a very early, very important test of parenthood, keeping track of your kids. Mr. Callanan, the social worker, said when she called back, she sounded anxious. I'm so sorry, you called rather late. And then she worked her way around to tell me that it was too late, that Lucy's remains had been taken from the hospital and cremated. I hung up and told Susan. Where? Susan asked. Where was she cremated? Where is she now? I shook my head. Susan closed her eyes. I picked up the phone once more. Oh, yes, the man answered at the mortuary. They'd collected hospital remains the month we'd lost her daughter. He even had a list of names. I gave him Lucy's and he put me on hold. Nope, he said amiably when he returned. I started talking, almost babbling, frantic to lose her when we'd drawn so close. Finally, something I said caused him to realize that Lucy was not a premature, but stillborn, tiny, and he stopped me. A stillborn? Well, he said. There were things that I did not understand. That's small, you see, he said, as though we were talking about someone else's daughter, someone else entirely. The bones, the skin, she might have just evaporated. You know what percentage of the body is water? I said nothing. How could I? I wasn't breathing. Well, it's 70 or 80%, and honestly, at that age, the skeleton's so new, and you know what? There's probably nothing left of her afterwards. Take dinosaurs, he said, warming to his explanation as I sank straight down the wall. Huge, huge, the big bones. That's why you have your fossils. Perhaps he thought I was still listening. I was glad Susan was not. No, we're mostly water, he said. And some, when cremated, some babies just evaporate. They're all water, through and through, he repeated, as though I needed convincing, as though Susan did, as though we had not cried enough to know this was true. A few months later, I was offered a big promotion at work, but I resigned instead. For some time, we had been saving up money so I could quit and write, but I'm not sure either Susan or I thought that I ever really would, especially once a baby arrived. That would have been too irresponsible, but now I understood what irresponsible really meant. I had given Lucy up. We had lost a baby, but I had lost the body, and though I wasn't sure what I would do, I knew I wouldn't find it at my desk at work. I turned in my pager, never having deleted that message about the silent heartbeat. At home, I roamed the bookshelves, and one day I came across a tiny bookmark peeking out from in between two books. I don't remember now what the bookmark was, just that it had been a favorite one and missing for some time. And upon seeing it, my mind said, well, here she is, here's Lucy. And it took me a moment, it took several moments for me to disentangle the semantic trick my mind had fallen for, that it had confused loss with lost, that part of me was still searching for something, that my mind now conflated all lost objects with the one great loss in our life. That bookmark is a ready metaphor for a writer, isn't it? He finds his disappeared daughter in books. But I've typed enough now to know that this is untrue. The only things found in books are what's put in them. And though I wrote Lucy into my novel, she keeps slipping out. She was not my first girlfriend, she was my daughter, but I have no evidence of this, no photograph, no remains. After years of avoiding that part of town, I recently drove by the hospital only to discover that the building is gone, knocked down. All that's left a giant hole in the ground, which leaves me with nothing. Just a stranger's hunch that she evaporated, a hunch that on idle days leaves me studying each passing cloud. A few years ago, we were back in the doctor's office. Susan was pregnant again, though this was not a happy visit. We had just started bleeding off and on early. The doctor knew and ushered us in and began to explain how a fetal heartbeat monitor worked and how it would let us hear our child's heartbeat for the first time and how reassured we would be. Susan gently cut him short and said, The last time I saw one of these was when I learned our baby had died. The doctor froze, and then with his hand stalled an inch above Susan's belly, commenced a series of rapid-fire explanations why we might not hear anything that day. Nothing at all, but really that was fine. He had a little ultrasound unit just down the hall. We just wandered down there if we had questions. Susan nodded. He touched the monitor to her timidly, as though he were lighting a fuse. A thumping beat suddenly ran round the room. He looked up and beamed. It's a girl. It was just a guess. It was too early for us to know for sure. Too early to know that it would be a girl, that we would name her Mary Grace, that she would astound and delight and sadden us just a bit, because it was only then that we realized the full extent of what we'd lost. It was also too early to know that Mary Grace would gain another sister, Honor, 2 years later, and it was still too early to know or even imagine that the day would come when we would smile, even laugh on Father's Day, watching our girls romp about, realizing that Lucy, how she pushed me to love, to live, to never forget, was herself the greatest Father's Day gift I would ever receive. It was too early for all of that, but there in the doctor's office, it was too soon for one more thing. The doctor began to remove the monitor. Susan stopped him. Just a little longer, she said. And he nodded and lowered his head and let the monitor beat on and on and on. Thump, 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 thump. It raced wildly, steadily, while the three of us remained absolutely still. Write what you don't know. What those of us who teach writing do know is that no advice, no rule, no wisdom applies to every writer. What works for me won't work for another. When I teach, I offer up different approaches, methods, guidelines, so the students can experiment with what works best for them. It's not always something they know or I know at the outset. What about when they want to write about something they do know and know well? Personal stories, sometimes deeply personal, sometimes so much so that they register only pain on the page and nothing more. With these students, I sit down and I ask them to tell me about their story, about what they've written, and then I ask them if they really are ready to tell it, or if this workshop is where they want to tell it. Sometimes what they don't know is that they're not ready to tell a particular story. When I began The Cloud Atlas, I was ready to tell a story, but I wasn't ready to tell a secret, and neither was my character, Lily. And over the course of several drafts, her secret emerged. She, too, had had an invisible child. And as it did, I had to determine whether I was ready to tell her story and whether it really was hers or mine. It turned out to be hers because hers and mine ended dramatically differently. Her caregivers failed her, whereas ours eventually came to our aid. One caregiver who initially failed Lily was a Yupik shaman, Ronnie, who years later finds himself living out his days in the same remote Alaskan town as the novel's narrator, who long ago left his bomb disposal days behind to become a priest. Decades after their original encounter on the tundra, they come together again. It's too late to help Lily this time, but it's not too late to help, as the narrator explains in this passage late in the book, which would be the last thing I read. I have seen Ronnie fire a gun only once, Ronnie the shaman, but it was to great effect. A couple had lost their child. It was a tiny child, a baby girl who, like Lily's child, was stillborn. But the baby was terribly early, terribly small, and the whole thing so horrifying that when the couple was asked immediately afterward if they'd like the hospital to take care of things, they numbly agreed without knowing what they were agreeing to. The hospital cremated the body. They found this out a few days later when the husband returned to claim the body. He was told it had been cremated. Shocked, he asked for remains. Alarmed, the hospital told him there weren't any. Our bodies are mostly water, the man was told, and tiny babies like yours. Sometimes they simply evaporate. There's nothing left. The man returned to his wife, and then the two found me beyond grief, even past rage. I did what I could. I arranged a memorial service for their child. I offered to secure an empty burial plot where they could place a marker, but they wanted more. So I summoned the shaman, I summoned Ronnie. He talked with me and then the couple, and then he told me to meet him outside the hospital. 2 days' time, 5 p.m. Though it was July, the sky had gone dark early, black with threatening clouds. I found Ronnie and the couple in the small play yard outside the hospital and watched as he threw a handful of ashes north and then south, east and west. The couple looked on, stupefied. Ronnie dusted his hands of the ashes and then reached into a small pouch. I expected him to remove some amulet or tiny mask. Instead, he removed an old, rusted .38. The wife looked terrified and grabbed her husband. The husband maintained a kind of crumbling defiance. Shoot me, his face said. Shoot us both. We no longer want to live. But Ronnie shot a god instead. He raised the gun over his head, shouted angrily, and fired. It's hard to describe how perfect an act this was, but the evidence was on the couple's faces, first the husband's and then the wife's. Here was the angry retort they had so wanted to send to heaven, futile as an oath and so completely satisfying. But Ronnie wasn't finished, though, or heaven wasn't. The rain began, slowly and then heavier and heavier. And the couple started to move toward shelter, but Ronnie told them to stay. They looked puzzled, sad, depleted. Ronnie held his face to the sky, soaking it. And then looking at the couple, he slowly wiped his face and presented them his hands, the water pooling in the creases of his palms. It was pouring now, so I couldn't hear what he said then, but I could just about make out his lips. She's here. They were too stunned to move at first, and then the father and the mother raised their faces to the flood and wept as the clouds their baby had evaporated into returned their daughter to them. Write what you don't know, is what I tell student writers, because the truth is even scarier. What you don't know until you do write is that to write is to possess an awesome power, to erase ignorance, to create knowledge, to summon life. Lewis Belk is a fictional character. He emailed me. The truth is, I've never fired a revolver. I fired that revolver. I never found my daughter. The truth is, I found her here. Thank you.